Chapter 32. Only for a few moments, but it was long enough for her silence to communicate all that he had to say, and for him to feel that only one thing mattered. He must do nothing to make this meeting their last. He must leave their future in her care, asking only that she should keep fast hold of it. Don't be unhappy, she said, with a break in her voice, as she drew her hands away, and he answered. You won't go back, you won't go back, as if it were the one possibility he could not bear. I won't go back, she said, and turning away she opened the door, and led the way into the public dining room. The strident school teachers were gathering up their possessions preparatory to a straggling flight to the wharf. Across the beach lay the white steamboat at the pier, and over the sunlit waters Boston loomed in a line of haze. XXV. Once more on the boat, and in the presence of others, Archer felt a tranquility of spirit that surprised as much as it sustained him. The day, according to any current valuation, had been a rather ridiculous failure. He had not so much as touched Madame Olenska's hand with his lips, or extracted one word from her that gave promise of farther opportunities. Nevertheless, for a man sick with unsatisfied love, and parting for an indefinite period from the object of his passion, he felt himself almost humiliatingly calm and comforted. It was the perfect balance as he had held between their loyalty to others, and their honesty to themselves that had so stirred, and yet tranquilized him, a balance not artfully calculated, as her tears and her falterings showed, but resulting naturally from her unabashed sincerity. It filled him with a tender awe, now the danger was over, and made him thank the fates that no personal vanity, no sense of playing a part before sophisticated witnesses, had tempted him to tempt her. Even after they had clasped hands for goodbye at the Fall River station, and he had turned away alone, the conviction remained with him of having saved out of their meeting much more than he had sacrificed. He wandered back to the club, and went and sat alone in the deserted library, turning and turning over in his thoughts every separate second of their hours together. It was clear to him, and it grew more clear under closer scrutiny, that if she should finally decide on returning to Europe, returning to her husband, it would not be because her old life tempted her, even on the new terms offered. No. She would go, only if she felt herself becoming a temptation to Archer, a temptation to fall away from the standard they had both set up. Her choice would be to stay near him, as long as he did not ask her to come nearer, and it depended on himself to keep her just there, safe but secluded. In the train these thoughts were still with him. They enclosed him in a kind of golden haze, through which the faces about him looked remote and indistinct. He had a feeling that if he spoke to his fellow travelers they would not understand what he was saying. In this state of abstraction he found himself, the following morning, waking to the reality of a stifling September day in New York. The heat-withered faces in the long train streamed past him, and he continued to stare at them through the same golden blur. But suddenly, as he left the station, one of the faces detached itself, came closer and forced itself upon his consciousness. It was, as he instantly recalled, the face of the young man he had seen, the day before, passing out of the Parker house, and had noted as not conforming to type, as not having an American hotel face. The same thing struck him now, and again he became aware of a dim stir of former associations. The young man stood looking about him with the dazed air of the foreigner flung upon the harsh mercies of American travel. Then he advanced toward Archer, lifted his hat, and said in English, "Early, monsieur, we met in London?" "Ah, to be sure. In London." Archer grasped his hand with curiosity and sympathy. "Oh, you did get here after all," he exclaimed, casting a wondering eye on the astute and haggard little countenance of young Carfrey's French tutor. "Oh, I got here, yes," M. Riviere smiled with drawn lips. "But not for long. I return the day after tomorrow." He stood grasping his light valise in one neatly gloved hand, and gazing anxiously, perplexedly, almost appealingly, into Archer's face. I wonder, monsieur, since I've had the good luck to run across you, if I might, I was just going to suggest it. Come to luncheon, won't you? Downtown, I mean. If you'll look me up in my office, I'll take you to a very decent restaurant in that quarter. M. Riviere was visibly touched and surprised. You're too kind. But I was only going to ask if you would tell me how to reach some sort of conveyance. There are no porters, and no one here seems to listen, I know. Our American stations must surprise you. When you ask for a porter, they give you chewing gum. But if you'll come along, I'll extricate you, and you must really lunch with me, you know. The young man, after a just perceptible hesitation, replied, with profuse thanks, and in a tone that did not carry complete conviction, that he was already engaged. But when they had reached the comparative reassurance of the street, he asked if he might call that afternoon. Archer, at ease in the midsummer leisure of the office, fixed an hour, and scribbled his address, which the Frenchman pocketed with reiterated thanks, and a white flourish of his hat. A horse car received him, and Archer walked away. Punctually at the hour, M. Riviere appeared, shaved, smoothed out, but still unmistakably drawn and serious. Archer was alone in his office, and the young man, before accepting the seat he proffered, began abruptly. I believe I saw you, sir, yesterday in Boston. The statement was insignificant enough, and Archer was about to frame an assent, when his words were checked by something mysterious, yet illuminating in his visitor's insistent gaze. It is extraordinary, very extraordinary, M. Riviere continued, that we should have met in the circumstances in which I find myself. What circumstances? Archer asked, wondering a little crudely if he needed money. M. Riviere continued to study him with tentative eyes. Have come, not to look for employment, as I spoke of doing when we last met, but on a special mission, Archer exclaimed. In a flash, the two meetings had connected themselves in his mind. He paused to take in the situation thus suddenly lighted up for him, and M. Riviere also remained silent, as if aware that what he had said was enough. A special mission, Archer at length repeated. The young Frenchman, opening his palms, raised them slightly, and the two men continued to look at each other across the office desk till Archer roused himself to say, "Oh, sit down," whereupon M. Riviere bowed, took a distant chair, and again waited. It was about this mission that you wanted to consult me? Archer finally asked. M. Riviere bent his head. Not in my own behalf. On that score I have fully dealt with myself. I should like, if I may, to speak to you about the Countess Olenska. Archer had known for the last few minutes that the words were coming, but when they came they sent the blood rushing to his temples, as if he had been caught by a bent back branch in a thicket. And on whose behalf, he said, do you wish to do this? M. Riviere met the question sturdily. I might say hers, if it did not sound like a liberty. Shall I say instead, on behalf of abstract justice? Archer considered him ironically. In other words, you are Count Olenski's messenger? He saw his blush more darkly reflected in M. Riviere's sallow countenance. Ah, to you, monsieur. If I come to you, it is on quite other grounds. What right have you, in the circumstances, to be on any other ground? Archer retorted. If you're an emissary, you're an emissary. The young man considered. Why, mission is over. As far as the Countess Olenska goes, it has failed. I can't help that, Archer rejoined on the same note of irony. No. But you can help. M. Riviere paused, turned his hat about in his still carefully gloved hands, looked into its lining, and then back at Archer's face. Who can help, monsieur, I am convinced, to make it equally a failure with her family? Archer pushed back his chair and stood up. And by God I will, he exclaimed. He stood with his hands in his pockets, staring down wrathfully at the little Frenchman, whose face, though he too had risen, was still an inch or two below the line of Archer's eyes. M. Riviere paled to his normal hue, paler than that his complexion could hardly turn. "Why the devil," Archer explosively continued, "should you have thought, since I suppose you're appealing to me on the ground of my relationship to Madame Olenska, that I should take a view contrary to the rest of her family?" The change of expression in M. Riviere's face was for a time his only answer. His look passed from timidity to absolute distress. For a young man of his usually resourceful mien, it would have been difficult to appear more disarmed and defenseless. "H. Monsieur, I can't imagine," Archer continued, "why you should have come to me when there are others, so much nearer to the Countess. Still less why you thought I should be more accessible to the arguments I suppose you were sent over with." M. Riviere took this onslaught with a disconcerting humility. "The arguments I want to present to you, monsieur, are my own, and not those I was sent over with." "Then I see still less reason for listening to them." M. Riviere again looked into his hat, as if considering whether these last words were not a sufficiently broad hint to put it on and be gone. Then he spoke with sudden decision. "Monsieur, will you tell me one thing? Is it my right to be here that you question? Or do you perhaps believe the whole matter to be already closed?" His quiet insistence made Archer feel the clumsiness of his own bluster. M. Riviere had succeeded in imposing himself. Archer, reddening slightly, dropped into his chair again, and signed to the young man to be seated. "I beg your pardon. But why isn't the matter closed?" M. Riviere gazed back at him with anguish. "You do, then, agree with the rest of the family that, in face of the new proposals I have brought, it is hardly possible for Madame Olenska not to return to her husband?" "Good God!" Archer exclaimed, and his visitor gave out a low murmur of confirmation. "Before seeing her, I saw at Count Olenski's request Mr. Lovell Mingott, with whom I had several talks, before going to Boston. I understand that he represents his mother's view, and that Mrs. Manson Mingott's influence is great throughout her family." Archer sat silent, with the sense of clinging to the edge of a sliding precipice. The discovery that he had been excluded from a share in these negotiations, and even from the knowledge that they were on foot, caused him a surprise hardly dulled by the acuter wonder of what he was learning. He saw in a flash that if the family had ceased to consult him, it was because some deep tribal instinct warned them that he was no longer on their side. And he recalled, with a start of comprehension, a remark of May's during their drive home from Mrs. Manson Mingott's on the day of the archery meeting. Perhaps, after all, Ellen would be happier with her husband. Even in the tumult of new discoveries, Archer remembered his indignant exclamation, and the fact that since then his wife had never named Madame Olenska to him. Her careless allusion had no doubt been the straw held up to see which way the wind blew. The result had been reported to the family, and thereafter Archer had been tacitly omitted from their councils. He admired the tribal discipline which made May bow to this decision. She would not have done so, he knew, had her conscience protested. But she probably shared the family. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.